Good morning. Business policy and a showcase of local products are on the agenda at next week's Hawaii on the Hill. Chamber of Commerce Hawaii CEO Sherry Manoa McNamara looks at the third annual D.C. trip. And on the subject of trips, one may not fit in your budget this year, and instead your time off may find you at home. Not a bad thing, with Honolulu on the list of best cities for a staycation. Wallet Hub's Jill Gonzalez joins us later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkut. We'd be remiss if we didn't remind you that it's Hemp History Week, and it's a history that goes back 10,000 years. Maui is celebrating with a 9-day Hemp Fest. And how playwright Susan Soonhee Stanton followed her talent to a writing career in New York with the help of some early and valuable inspiration.
That's the conversation. Next, the news.
I do believe I'm gonna clap my hands. I think I'm gonna tap my feet. I'll get together one man band, walk down that street. I'll have a one-man parade. Yeah, nobody needs to know.
And good morning and welcome to the conversation. That was, of course, Jimmy Borges, who left us earlier this week and went on his own one-man parade to whatever happens next, but we all miss him greatly.
And left us with a wonderful legacy, Beth Ann.
And that's the part that we have to remember,
that's
too,
right,
and the way in which he chose to go out of this life. A lot of dignity and a lot of grace in that, too.
You bet.
So this morning, we are going to continue on as we are wont to do and talk about something that maybe you don't think about a whole lot, maybe a little business activities. Now, for the third year in a row, Chamber of Commerce Hawaii members are going to be converging on Washington, D.C. That happens next week. On the agenda during the two-day trip is policy to benefit Hawaii's businesses, along with an event to spotlight homegrown industry, products, and food. There will be tours of the Capitol, along with a talk story with Senator Mazie Hirono, the Chamber's partner and chair of Hawaii on the Hill. But what tangible results will make this trip more than fun in the process of promotion? Chamber of Commerce Hawaii President and CEO Sherry Manoa McNamara joins us now with her list. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
First time when we talked 3 years ago when you were just starting this and just trying to see whether this would be a good activity and whether people would participate. Well, they did.
Yes.
And it's been going along ever since. But what do you now have as some sort of, you know, list of what expectations might be fulfilled by this trip?
Sure. So each year it has grown. As you mentioned, we started this 3 years ago in partnership with Senator Hirono and her team in an effort to showcase Hawaii's products and industries to our nation's leaders. We felt that it was really important to keep Hawaii in the discussions on Capitol Hill, to keep Hawaii on the radar, and to really show that Hawaii plays a pivotal and strategic role in our nation's policies. And so that's one of the reasons why we decided, the Chamber decided to take on this initiative to be part of that effort. And we are so proud that for this year, we have more than 50 businesses represented, ranging from small business to large businesses across the islands. We have quite a number of businesses from Kauai attending, as well as Maui, Molokai, Hawaii Island, as well as Oahu. And so we are there, and many of them have gone in previous years, but they recognize the importance of continuing to go and have that opportunity to showcase our industries and stress to the policymakers why these industries are important.
And in so doing, perhaps disabuse them of some ideas that they may have of Hawaii. I mean, it always interests me when we travel that people say things about Hawaii and you wonder how on earth did they get those ideas. And in part simply because they haven't had the experience of what Hawaii is really about.
Right. And as you know, we were obviously known for our tourism industry. And while the tourism industry will be our number one industry, as well as the military as our number two, there's so many number other industries represented that really stimulates Hawaii's economy, not only within our state, but also across the nation as well as internationally.
So what would surprise people to know is on that list?
So we are having a policy summit Next Tuesday, or the day before our TASTE event, Senator Tirone and her team puts together the summit with various leaders. And this year's issues will touch upon small business development, international commerce, workforce development and diversity, health policy, renewable energy, and agriculture.
That's a huge list.
It is. And we have quite a number of speakers as well lined up.
So what comes out of that list, or comes out of a two-day trip where you have so much compressed into that, that would make a tangible difference in the lives of business people in Hawaii?
Right. So one of the reasons why we do this policy summit is, one, to provide an opportunity for the participants to understand what kind of resources government provides to help their businesses grow. And so this provides them that access to be able to ask questions of any resource they may want to know about, or any questions they may have about the agency itself. But really, once again, to have that intimate conversation with leading policymakers.
And how much of that is driven toward export?
Some of them, well, it all depends. So what we do is, before we go up, we ask the participants what issues they would like to cover. And based on that, Senator Hirona and her team reaches out to the appropriate people.
So what was really on the top of mind for many of the participants this year? You mentioned so many of them are new.
Right. So this year, the panel, the summit includes speakers from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Center for American Progress, U.S. Department of Energy, Department of Ag, and a small business panel, which will be represented by the Minority Business Development Agency and the Office of Minority and Women Inclusion. In addition to that, we are also meeting with the U.S. Chamber, who will provide us with an update on various issues, including international trade policy and customs and trade facilitation. So once again, it's an opportunity for our participants to really understand what government's role is, what resources they provide to help their businesses succeed.
Are there issues that you have had surface over the last couple of years since you started this initiative that weren't as well known or as well discussed as you think that maybe they have been now because businesses have been exposed to the Hawaii on the Hill initiative?
Right. So a couple of years ago, we launched a manufacturing in Hawaii initiative in an effort to promote the Hawaii brand, as well as make products in Hawaii for Hawaii. And we've seen a revitalization of that industry in Hawaii, from the state legislature support to the admin support in supporting the manufacturing industry. And as a result, we are the exclusive association for the National Association of Manufacturers that is based in D.C. And so I believe that we're seeing more attention paid to this industry in Hawaii, not only within our state policymakers on a state level, but also on a federal level, because we've been able to bring our manufacturers to Hawaii on the Hill and also have them have discussions with the policymakers based on manufacturing to see what kind of grants are out there, what kind of resources are out there. In addition to the manufacturing industry, also innovation in industry in Hawaii. So we've been able to meet with professionals as well as government officials in that area to support our efforts in growing both industries.
Manufacturing is a big umbrella.
Yes.
What specifically has been brought back to Hawaii or been started in Hawaii that we don't know so much about?
Well, one is to raise awareness of our existing manufacturing industry. There's a lot more manufacturing companies that some may be aware of. When we think manufacturing, I think many of us think of car manufacturing or clothing. But there's a lot more going on here than many would think, ranging from obviously the food. There's a lot of food manufacturing from the small manufacturers to even large manufacturers. We have technology manufacturing. There's a lot of products being made here for the defense industry. So there's a wide range of manufacturers here. And while we may not be that big manufacturing industry that we see in other states, we have a niche market manufacturing industry here.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing what happens when you come back.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Sherry Manoa McNamara is President and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii. The third effort to bring Hawaii industry and businesses to Washington happens next week.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, a look at the past and the future of hemp. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a local woman who became the first from Hawaii to be named Miss America. She was born in Kona in 1967 and was educated on the mainland at Columbia River Bible Church and Academy in Kettle Falls, Washington. She came back to Hawaii for college and financed her education at HPU with victories in local pageants, including Miss Kona Coffee and Miss Hawaii Pacific University. She entered the Miss Hawaii pageant three times before winning in 1991, a victory that allowed her to compete in the 1992 Miss America contest, where she won it all. She'd hoped to spend her Miss America year promoting education, but a news leak about a past abusive relationship focused attention on her as a victim of domestic violence. She became a spokesperson for domestic abuse victims in response and starred in a television movie about her experience. This morning, we're looking for her name, and we'll be back with it in about half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the HPR T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Jed Gaines from Read Aloud America. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hemp can lay a claim to the title of world's most misunderstood weed. This in spite of its 10,000-year history, in which it has been used for everything from beer, clothing, and rope to biofuel and animal feed. Steve Rose is president of the Maui Hemp Institute for Research and Innovation, whose 9-day Hemp Fest begins this weekend. It's part of a nationwide Hemp History Week, and Steve's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Steve.
Aloha, Chris.
What are the most misunderstood aspects of hemp?
Well, one that it's something bad. I mean, hemp has been with human civilization traced back thousands and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. It's only been banned out of our lifestyles for about the past 80 years. So there's a lot of misinformation out there caused by the banning and a lot of just non-knowing about the benefits of hemp. And when we realize there are thousands and thousands of benefits of hemp, we get all excited about it, and we see a very bright future in front of us.
Well, it's pretty easy to grow, right? It grows quickly and in a variety of soils. Is that right?
Well, basically, it's kind of the plant that's called a weed. So you stick it in the ground, you water it, and it grows.
Yeah.
What comes up, you know, can be made better by, you know, cultivating it and, you know, picking the right seeds in the right climates. But basically, there's what they call ditch weed all over the United States where hemp once grew. Some of it dates back hundreds of years, and it never gets eradicated pretty much.
That ditch weed, wasn't that in part being used to make rope during wartime? I heard that somewhere.
Well, it was basically the ban was lifted during World War II. We actually grew hemp here in Hawaii. The Oahu farmers were the first that were pressed into service after the Philippines were taken over by the Japanese. America lost its only source of hemp, and all our ships used hemp for their anchor ropes, and even the parachutes had hemp rope lining. President Bush probably wouldn't have made it if his hemp parachute didn't save his life.
Well, that versatility is recognized during wartime, but why was it but the ban went back into effect after the Second World War ended?
Yeah, they just basically went back to where it was. There's a wonderful movie on YouTube called Hemp for Victory that was found in the archives, and it's a wonderful 10-minute thing on the revitalization of hemp to support the war effort. You can be found on our YouTube Maui Hemp channel also.
Because you can make so many...
Basically, they just turned right around and went back to the ban after the war.
But there was at least momentary recognition of all the things you can do with it, and you see that recognition returning now, don't you?
Well, during the war, it was basically primary. They just needed rope. But now, you know, especially with the Internet being able to spread information, the many, many uses of hemp are coming out there. With its legalization in many states on the mainland, it's actually being grown and products are starting to be developed. And the most recent thing right now is battery technology. They're discovering that the microfibers in hemp are some of the best conductors for batteries that will be biodegradable. We have cars being made of hemp now, and there's even a Kickstarter to make an airplane out of hemp. Not that this hasn't been done before. Henry Ford built a hemp car back in the day and was about to produce it before the anti-hemp forces basically put him out of business with that idea.
You know, I know that it's great for flexible things like rope, but you can make something as solid as an automobile out of hemp?
Well, hemp is, the resins are made into plastic, and that's one of our futures here in Hawaii. We can't wait to see surfboards with hemp resin on them and canoes with hemp resin. It's as hard as any plastic. One of the other uses of hemp with the leftover fiber after harvest is for something called hempcrete, which is like concrete, 3 times stronger. It breathes. It's mold resistant. We have a couple of houses here now being built of hempcrete here on Maui as kind of showcases. But we actually can begin to grow our houses here once our hemp industry gets up and running again.
If you wanted to start, assuming legal barriers were out of the way, what would you need to get a hemp crop started in Hawaii?
Well, right now, we just had our growing bill passed by the legislature. We're waiting for the governor to sign it and a permitting process, which will be enacted. Once that happens, we'll basically start growing hemp. We have to find seed sources. There's not a lot of seed in this 30 states now growing on the mainland. But that's one of the futures that we see here on Maui, and one of the reasons for the Institute is basically to determine, you know, what seeds grow best in what climates. We have 20-some-odd microclimates here on Maui where we can begin to do that research, and that's one of the first priorities of the Institute is to not only identify what seeds grow in what temperatures, but to work with private companies to begin that grow-out operation to produce a large amount of seed. We can grow 3 crops of hemp here on Maui and Hawaii. We're on the mainland in Colorado. They get 1 crop. So it gives us a vast research body field to begin to work with. And that's one of the exciting things about hemp and coming to Hawaii again.
Sounds as if there's a great deal still to be learned. It's not quite as simple as throwing a weed onto the ground and watching it grow, yeah?
Well, basically that'll happen. What you get, you know, you can grow it 8 to 10 feet tall and get more fiber, or you can grow it 3 feet tall and get a lot of seed. What most people don't realize is that most of the value in the hemp crop is actually in the seed, which is loaded with omega-3 oil and high proteins. That oil can also be made into biofuels, and that's what eventually winds up in the resins. So, yes, there's a lot to learn. That's one of the basic reasons we formed the Research Institute, because we see there's going to be a need for a lot of research as literally a multi-billion dollar industry begins to emerge in the United States, and probably $100 million industry here in the state of Hawaii over the next 10 years.
Well, getting back to what I was saying about getting an operation started, for example, how much land would you need?
Well, again, it depends the model that you're doing it. You know, if you're growing it for large quantities of hemp for biofuel and fiber, that would be a larger operation, and we'd have to do the research on the yields. The focus of the Institute right now is how do we make it work for, you know, us local folk and our farmers, and we have some models set up for sustainable agriculture, where hemp is the first crop that goes in that actually remediates the soil, pulls out the heavy metals, and then begins the enriching of the soil with some other processes to begin to grow food. One of our first research projects that we started this year with Simply Fresh Farms in Lahaina is what we called our hemp-infused food forest, where as soon as we grow hemp, we're going to put up a protective barrier of hemp around an area that's already been turned into soil through Korean natural farming methods and is growing all the canoe plants and many, many food plants. And this is a model that can be done on an acre or less even, and actually feed a family and then some once it's up and running.
Well, it certainly sounds as if there's a great deal of there's a world of possibility here, Steve. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Surely. Thank you very much.
Steve Rose is a self-described hempster from over 45 years. He's president of the Maui Hemp Institute for Research and Innovation, whose 9-day Hemp Fest begins this Friday at the Maui Brewing Company in Kihei. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
The new film comedy Pop Star is about a hip-hop group whose frontman, played by Andy Samberg, goes solo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Samberg and the film's directors, co-writers, and co-stars, Yorma Taconi and Akiva Schaffer. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Once upon a time, there was a radio station that told important stories and told them well. Once Upon a Time is still now, and we thank station members who believe in Hawaii Public Radio and the stories we tell. Those would include Arlene Inouye of Honolulu, C.J. Kimberly of Kailua Kona, and Noel Villamil of Honolulu. If you'd also like to live happily ever after with HPR, your membership dollars will help. You can reach us at 955-8821 during business hours or at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
You probably have a calendar with important dates logged to remember. One that might not be on your list is this Friday as the walkaway date in the deal between HEI and NextEra. But according to the Public Utilities Commission and the utility, a date may just be a date. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So how important is this June 3rd date after this 17-month journey that we've been on with this deal?
Well, you know, Hawaiian Electric is downplaying the date. They're saying it's not as big of a deal. But let's be clear, if for some reason either company wanted to walk away from the merger, the one that is before the PUC right now for consideration, a $4.3 billion merger deal, well, they would have to have a payout, a $90 million in fees, a termination fee, another $5 million for other expenses. So a $95 million price tag to walk away. Hawaiian Electric has not indicated in any way that they plan to do that. They have not, however, had any communication with NextEra, the Florida company, about this. NextEra did not comment to Nathan Eagle, our reporter, about what they think about Friday's deadline.
Is HEI particularly concerned about that fee of $95 million?
It's a lot of money, and certainly if for some reason NextEra walked away, they would get that money. The board of directors for Hawaiian Electric would have to decide what to do with it. Does the money go to the shareholders? Does it go for other uses? Would it be a rebate for customers like us? Who knows? But they were saying maybe there's a misconception about this deadline. They feel that the two companies don't necessarily have to agree to extend the deadline. They didn't say much more about it than that. We actually had them visiting our Silver Beat offices the other day. But be that as it may, the deadline does exist, and we'll find out Friday what will happen. In the meantime, the PUC chair, Randy Wasse, says he does not think a decision will be made by Friday in terms of the merger, probably later this summer. And in no way does he say they feel any pressure to be worried about this particular deadline.
Which kind of brings up the idea whether that just is perhaps a strategy to let HEI and NextEra have to perhaps part company, or whether the PUC will put so many conditions on it if they do approve the deal that maybe one or both of the companies will say no thanks.
All right, and that's the option. The PUC can just flat out reject it. They can approve it, or they can sign off with conditions. And the conditions is something that a lot of folks think are likely to happen. Whether or not that's acceptable to the two companies, they then could either accept what the PU says, they could ask the PUC to reconsider, or they could take the issue to court. Boy, wouldn't that take forever to resolve?
And cost a whole lot more money, too. Really clear that this is not necessarily it's going to get anything said or done or wrapped up by this Friday.
Right, and let's just quickly sum up the two sides. Both companies, Hawaiian Electric and NextEra, insist that this deal is in the public's interest, that customer savings are involved, that a way to wean us off imported oil. But we know the people that oppose it. They include Governor David Ige, the state consumer advocate, all sorts of groups that have filed with the PUC against this. And there's also the issue of LNG, liquefied natural gas, something that Hawaiian Electric wants as a bridge fuel to getting us off of fossil fuels. Governor Ige opposes that as well. So by now, the two camps are clearly spelled out. It's been 17 months and counting. Will we finally have some resolution coming shortly? Well, we'll be back to report on it. You can bet on that.
That's right. And guess what? I would say probably not going to be resolving anytime soon.
Agreed.
All right. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert's going to tell us about underwater robots, yeah?
Well, there's another program. You know, we had the folks come on and talk about Sea Perch. This is kind of the a little bit more complex robotics program, still organized and sponsored by the Coast Guard. It's called MATE, ROV, and MATE stands for Marine Advanced Technologies Education, and ROV is Remote Operated Vehicle. And what they basically do is they take these underwater vehicles, and they actually have to do a whole set of exercises. So it's like a simulation of, let's say, going to another planet or going into the deep ocean and trying to maneuver around, pick up, little objects, take the temperature of, this vent, maybe take a sample from, from the ocean and bring it back up and provide the judges, I guess, with the results. The interesting thing about these teams is that they are really set up as a business. So you have a CEO, Chief Executive Officer, you have a CFO doing the financials, and you also do have a technical lead. And the team goes in front of judges, and they basically pitch their their business and show what it is that they built, how much did it cost, and how what's the return on their investment in terms of building this ROV.
So it isn't just being able to do it, it's being able to pay for it.
It's exactly. It's not only doing it. It's like, how much did you guys spend on this? Did you spend thousands of dollars? Did you spend a couple hundred dollars? And how much, how well did you perform based on that budget? So it's a lot of interesting concepts that are rolled into this MATE ROV. And of course, just first and foremost, taking an this vehicle underwater is a difficult task in and of itself.
I would imagine. Well, thanks a lot, Bert. We'll look forward to that.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Tonight at 5. That's Bite Marks Cafe.
Good morning. It's now 8:33. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. If you'd like to be in touch, lots of ways to do that. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We're also on Twitter at HI Conversation, or get to me at BKOZHPR. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
Now look at the lighter side of life, your time off. Taking a trip, solo or with family, is often a greatly anticipated part of summer. For many people, though, it's just not possible every year. That's no problem if you happen to live in one of the nation's best cities for a staycation. And on this year's Wallet Hub list, Honolulu checks in at number 10. Wallet Hub spokesperson Jill Gonzalez joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Nice to talk to you again. Now, it's probably not a big surprise that spots 1, 2, and 3 are occupied by Florida locations, Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa. I mean, lots of good and fun stuff to do there. But beyond good and fun stuff in the way that we might think about those places, what else went into figuring out who had the best cities for the staycation?
Pretty much everything under the sun here. I mean, we looked at 28 different metrics across 150 of the largest U.S. cities, and those metrics fell into three distinct categories. So recreation is one, everything from public golf courses to swimming pools to tennis courts and baseball diamonds. We then looked at food and entertainment, so not only the number of nightlife options available or cultural centers, but also, you know, how much is admission to them. How many four-and-a-half-star restaurants are actually affordable within a city? And then finally, rest and relaxation, so everything from beaches to the cost of a hotel room.
How about fun stuff for families with kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So that would fall into both recreation and entertainment categories, everything from zoos, museums, attraction, and amusement parks, where, as you said, Florida really did come up number one here.
There were some interesting, you know, subsets to some of that, looking at most beer gardens per capita or most ice cream and frozen yogurt shops per capita. That's pretty important to some people.
Yeah, I mean, think about a staycation and doing things that, you know, are kind of key to summer. So whether you want an iced coffee or frozen yogurt, ice cream shop, I mean, some cities are decked out with them, and some really have very few. So if that's something that you know your kids are going to be looking for, then we looked at that. The same can be said for beer gardens. If your idea of getting a true vacation off is sitting outside and drinking some beer, we have the cities for you as well.
Looking at the map of the United States and the places that seem to have a lot of stuff going on, there just seems to be this big hole across the plains. Why?
Well, we're seeing that a lot of places either don't have the spas or museums, the nightlife options here, or they do, but they come at such a premium that it really doesn't make it worthwhile to even try to stay there.
So when we're looking at some of those states, it's not just because there's a great deal of expanse and you have to travel very far to get to some place, it's just simply they aren't there?
Exactly. They aren't there, or because there are such little supply to kind of go around, that that's when they can actually charge a higher price for some of those things.
Okay, so let's talk about our favorite city on this list, Honolulu. What made Honolulu come in at number 10 as opposed to something that might have been higher?
Sure. So Honolulu, first of all, it makes sense for a staycation because it's hard to get there and it's hard to leave from there. At least it's very expensive to do so. So you might as well stay there. It ranked number one in terms of hiking trails, also very high, obviously, in terms of beaches and relaxing spas and all of that, shopping centers, boat tours, and water sports. I think the only reason why it didn't rank as highly is that it is a little bit more expensive than a lot of other cities on the list.
how much more expensive compared to the other cities you looked at?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about going to an affordable restaurant or even getting a hotel, say if you are kind of staying by Honolulu or in Honolulu and you're coming from more of the suburbs around it, then that hotel room is going to cost you a little bit more.
But you can certainly be out there in a coffee or tea shop because we came in number five for that one.
That's right. Plenty of coffee and tea to go around, so you will at least be hydrated.
And as far as beaches and spas, I mean, even for spas, we came in second.
Yeah, that's another thing. The spas there just are a little bit more expensive than they would be in most other cities.
But it's, some people might be surprised at the number of spas. I mean, we have, you know, little day spas, and a lot of salons have their own spas. But when you talk about a spa, you mean a full-service spa.
Yeah, we're talking about full-service spas. They can be day spas as long as they offer, you know, massages and things like that, a little bit more than just a haircut, you know, get in and get out. But, yeah, Honolulu had number one. It was only tied with Vegas in terms of the number of wellness and spa centers.
So as you look at this whole idea of a staycation, and there have been a lot of people who, since the recession, have been looking at that as being the only way they can have a vacation, what are some of the psychological differences of being able to enjoy your own city versus enjoying somebody else's city?
I think that's one thing that consumers don't realize now. I mean, finding out these little gems and kind of trinkets in your own backyard really is a whole new way to experience it, no matter how long you've lived there, or if you have some family members that haven't seen as much. You know, that's always a great way to kind of get out. And if you have been planning on moving or, you know, planning on seeing another area nearby where you live, this is kind of like a great trial run. You know, have a little staycation, maybe Airbnb it or go to a bed and breakfast. Stay there for a few days and see what it would be like to live in a different neighborhood.
For a lot of us, we never really get out and see a lot of the attractions that are in Hawaii or even just move, you know, well beyond our own neighborhoods unless we have people come visit. And that the idea that you don't really know your area very well seems to be a good reason for getting out and about. Any sense of how many people now take a staycation versus what it used to be as just sort of, well, gee, too bad you couldn't go someplace else, but actually people who say now they like to stay at home?
Yeah, so of the people taking a vacation this year, about two-thirds of them are planning to stay local this year. So they can definitely rack up those vacation days, but they still can't necessarily or don't really want to spend the money on some airfare. They aren't inclined to driving for miles and miles and miles. So staycation is actually pretty popular now.
Well, we don't have miles and miles that we can drive, but we certainly hear you when it's a matter of getting on a plane to go anyplace else, including to a neighbor island. Thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Happy travels.
You too. Good to talk to you again. Jill Gonzalez is the spokesperson for Wallet Hub. Her take on consumer finance issues has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Kiplinger. If you're planning a staycation this year, we want to know. Give us a call at 808-792-8217.
Aloha, I'm Lavore Addison from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, studying theater. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, you remembered a local woman who was named Miss Hawaii, Miss America, in 1992. When news media learned of an abusive relationship in her past, she became the focus of unwanted national attention, attention she was able to leverage into a role as spokesperson for abuse victims. She helped found two organizations, Safe Places for Abused Women and Children and Give Back a Smile, and starred in a TV movie about her life. The movie was called Miss America Behind the Crown, and she described it this way, quote, "When I learned that abuse hotlines were receiving up to 1,000 calls a day, I decided I should make the movie. If Miss America can have this happen to her and get out of it, it'll help other people. Women can use my pain to help gain strength." Today, Carolyn Sapp Daniels is an actress, singer, stuntwoman, and motivational speaker remembered in Hawaii as Carolyn Sapp.
And Kathy Ihan knew that and called in, and we'll be getting the HPR T-shirt. It's now 8:47. That's today's quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Opportunities for artists to fully develop their talent and even make a living at it are all too rare, but with the right environment, talent will out. Hawaii-born playwright Susan Soonhi Stanton, whose play #IAmBadAtThis is currently running at Kumukahua, talked with us about what it takes to launch a playwriting career and the benefits of finding teachers who believe in you at an early age.
It all started, I took this playwriting class. It was a program through Honolulu Theater for Youth. It was called Theater Fest, and they had, you know, junior high and high school age kids writing plays, and then they were produced. Some of them even toured. And so at that really early age, you know, Dan Kellen at the time ran that program, and he took us so seriously. I mean, he took us very seriously at this very early age. We were accountable, and we got to see the plays that we wrote on stage. And so I wrote a play with Dan at HDY, and I sent it into NYU Tisch, and I got in, and then suddenly I was 17 and I was in New York, and I was really overwhelmed. I made every mistake. I got taken in a game of three card Monty. I was always lost. I think it was like my great uncle's army winter coat. It was the biggest, ugliest coat I've ever seen. And yeah, so that was where I started, was starting here and then coming to New York, and then really trying to find my way in New York and trying to figure out that balance between, I think, what it means to be from here and trying to make theater and make art and finding artistic homes and just conducive cities to do theater in.
And yet at a young age, you were made aware that these things were possible for you.
Yeah, I know I have a lot of friends who are so incredible and really bright and are searching for what they want to do. And it's very hard to be a playwright. Like, it is not the easiest or most sensible road by any means. But I always felt lucky that really early, for some reason, just playwriting really clicked, storytelling, dialogue, characters. And not just writing, but specifically playwriting and collaborating. It's just theater. Like, I don't know, everything came together for me just at that age.
But it often seems to me that if you give young people a sense of possibility, they're going to go a lot farther than anyone would have expected, including the kids themselves.
Yeah, I teach now, and it's amazing how far you can get kids if you really believe in them and you challenge them instead of saying, like, well, this is good enough. I mean, you don't want to stress them out, but when you have certain expectations and you push them, I mean, sometimes they really thrive with that kind of challenge.
Mm-hmm. The whole thing of every writer struggles with good enough, right? There comes a point when you want to say that this is a finished manuscript, and yet you don't want to be too complacent about your work. How do you strike that balance of you know, wanting to revise, and is it really ready? Is this my final draft?
I mean, for me, I think I keep working until they tell me that I have to stop. And plays for me are never done. I've heard this from a lot of other playwrights. Even Tony Kirshner, when they revised Angels in America, he was still changing the script. And so when I've had a play that felt right in this one production, then second time I'd change it. And I have certain plays, like for this, you know, for #IAmBadAtThis, there's a version of this play that is meant for local audiences, and then if I brought it to New York or a different place, that sort of local shorthand that I have, I'd have to shift that. I have to explain some of the words, or, you know, I'd have to deal with audiences that would be less familiar with certain things in terms of the humor or various references.
But you want it changed by you, right?
Well, yes. Always changed by me, yes.
Because, you know, movie screenwriters sell their script and then, or, you know, see heaven knows what happened to it. Playwrights are more protected, aren't they?
It's a double-edged sword, I guess. Film is theater is ephemeral, and film lasts forever.
Yeah.
But with film, you sell the rights to your film. You make a lot more money potentially, but you lose the rights to it. Whereas playwrights always own the rights to their plays. Like we never give that up, and so we are in control of every word. If a director cuts out a scene or changes something without our permission, we do have the right to close the production. Mm-hmm. So it really is, in a certain way, a playwright's medium.
So that definitely can work to your advantage in a lot of, if you want control over your creative output, playwriting rather than screenwriting might be a path to choose. Yeah?
Right. I mean, I think that it's so much of a conversation. I mean, you do have to, even though I do say like the playwrights have that kind of control, it really is about collaborating, trusting your director, listening to what they have to say. I mean, if everyone tells you should cut that scene, like maybe you should cut that scene.
Yeah.
And then if you do want 100% absolute control, I always think it's better to be a novelist because plays are blueprints. They're meant to be brought in with actors and designers. And also a play is never the same every night. The words that are said on stage are never completely the same every night. It's a living thing.
And it is, as you said, ephemeral. And I wonder how you deal with that because, you know, I feel that about music sometimes. You send a bunch of stuff into the air, which may or may not have been received, but it's gone at the conclusion of the performance.
I get so sad when a play of mine ends. It's I'm only here for till the opening weekend, and then I leave, and then I'll never get to see these wonderful actors in this play again, and it makes me so sad. But I guess it's part of the process. It's part of the excitement of sharing the work, is that you know. Whether it's a Broadway show that runs for 3 years or however many years, or a show that, you know, we're running about 5 weeks, it's still something that can't be forever.
Yeah.
And it's about being okay with that and letting go of it.
And I guess you must run into that in your teaching, Susan, you know, the whole thing of what to be prepared for when you become a playwright, as with any creative profession. What are the things that you need to be ready for? That's the kind of thing that your students want to know, yeah?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, when I was a student, it was just sort of like, how to handle your fame? Or I don't know. It was only the sort of best case scenario. And there's so many different ways in which we have to succeed as a playwright and market ourselves and just be prepared for things and really push. There's so many different paths to succeed. It's not necessarily like if you're a doctor, you have to get into the right medical school and then residency and, you know, this and that. I mean, there's not necessarily a path for playwrights to succeed. And you could do really well when you're 20 and then nothing for 30 years and then do really well again. Or,
yeah.
You know, there's so many different ways in which you can find success and how you define success as well.
Yeah, that's what's going to be my next question because, you know, in some ways you have to be your own yardstick of success, yeah?
I think so. I mean, for me, I think my yardstick is just, am I writing things that is meaningful to me and I'm hoping that is meaningful to other people? And am I working with people that I care about?
Susan Soonhee Stanton is a playwright and screenwriter in New York, originally from Aiea, Hawaii. Her plays include Whatever Happened to John Boy Quijano, The Underneath, Art of Preservation, and Navigator. Her new play, hashtag I Am Bad at This, is running at Kumukuhua Theater until June 26th.
Hedge funds, it turns out, are just like everybody else.
They want a relationship with power brokers in Washington who can help grease the skids on their agenda.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The politics of hedge fund economics, the numbers from Wall Street, and the rest of the day's business news, all next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Beth Ann, someday we may all live in hemp houses, drink hemp beer, wear hemp clothing, and drive a hemp car.
Could be. Right now you can get hemp soap and all kinds of other
yeah.
cosmetics that have hemp in them as well. But that's, you know, another industry that may turn up the next time around or in future trips when the Hawaii on the Hill, if that's continuing as an initiative of the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly its advocates tout all kinds of benefits for it as a business force, as the driver of a successful farming operation. It's not just for hippies anymore.
You might know something about that, would you?
There's a slogan for you, huh?
I remember you heard it with him first.
That's right.
But in all truth, we've talked about hemp for so many years and watching the College of Ag be able to get some seeds and start that plan and look at how or what grows here really well and how that can be a burgeoning industry and what will happen with that. Lots of interesting things for us to talk about, as we have lots of tomorrows, hopefully, to talk about them.
That it is.
But as long as we're going to talk about tomorrow, we're going to continue the conversation on Hawaii business, this time for Native Hawaiian entrepreneurs. Michelle Kahane, the president and CEO of the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, will be here.
And we'll hear some Southern Soul with Luther Dickinson and Andrews Osborne. And we'd like to hear from you. You can call us on our talkback line. Leave comments at 808-792-8217. If you'd like to email us, that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of the show, or if there's just something you want to hear again, you can do that by finding the show on the Conversation page that has links to more information about guests and topics. Look under Talk Shows for the Conversation. That's all on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of the Conversation.